Dan Rode, welcome to the Superstructure Podcast.
Thanks, Scott. I listen to you guys all the time. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we're really glad to have you. And we've asked you to join us today because recently you published a short vertical piece on the Superstructure Vertical called Bank of the People, History for Money's Future. And this was actually just a snippet of a forthcoming paper, a law paper that you have coming out in the Osgoode Hall Law Journal, which has a more elaborate title. What I'd like us to do is to kind of get into what motivated you to write this piece, what the stakes are for you, why is studying history and Canadian monetary history so important for thinking about money's future, its present. But maybe just to kick us off, you can tell our listeners a bit about who you are, what you're up to, what you're studying, your disciplinary context.
So after law school, I didn't go right into academia or graduate school, which is what I'm in now. I really wanted to try legal practice. So I worked at a union-side labor firm for a couple of years. I clerked at an appellate court. And then I worked at a legal clinic doing welfare appeals. And I was very committed to social justice litigation and, you know, advocacy in that space. That's really why I went to law school. But I had always thought about teaching, and I eventually thought I'd like to go back to it. I just thought I was cut out for it, that it would make for a nicer life. I'd always dreamed about it. And I kind of, at a certain point, decided, okay, stop putting it off. Just bite the bullet and you know, live out the dream that you keep thinking you're, you know, not quite cut out for, and just see what happens. So I was going to go back to school. I didn't know what to study. I didn't want to study labor law specifically, even though I'm very passionate about it, still committed to the labor movement in a big way. I still read all that scholarship. But instead, I wanted to do something a bit different. It felt like workers' rights advocates were too much on the side of, you know, every election cycle arguing maybe for more law or more regulation, and seeing themselves in opposition to, say, a business lobby or an employer lobby who was arguing for less law, less regulation. And it seemed to me that both sides of this debate, and by no means am I putting all labor law scholars in that basket at all, I'm talking about a generalization here, were missing the deeper role that law plays in these dynamics, and you know, setting up the whole bargaining chips, if you were, between employers and workers in the first place. And, you know, all the law that the employer side relies on routinely, and maybe regulations that, you know, labor lawyers and labor advocates would like to get off their backs. It just seemed like the debate was missing the foundations of capitalism, really. So I wanted to go back to school to do something about the foundations of capitalism. I didn't want to do labor law, even though that was the world I was coming from. And so literally, I went on SSRN. I pulled papers from every legal scholar I found doing legal foundations of capitalism. And I found a paper by Christine Dezan. You probably read it, called Law, Money as a Legal Institution. And, you know, every lunch break, I would take a paper down to so in downtown Toronto, that's where the clinic office was. The basements of all the buildings are connected, and there's like these food courts connected. They call it the path, not the path of New York City, not even like it. So it's like this like underground shopping mall. So I'm in this like windowless, you know, fluorescent lit hallway next to this coffee shop, reading a random paper every other day or something from a lunch break. And I found her paper and I thought, okay, this is it. If she'll take me as a student, this is what I want to do, because this is, I just thought it was the deepest, most fascinating, reflective bit of that work that I found. And then by some miracle, Harvard let me in and she took me on as a student. Thank God. And then it was just off to the races. I was completely hooked.
So can you talk a little bit about the kind of intellectual experience of reading that paper? I mean, did it speak to kind of hunches and impulses that you already had, but you maybe didn't have language for? Did you feel like, no, I'm already kind of there, but here's something that speaks to what I already think? Or was it, you know, or was it fully mind blowing and reframing of the way you think about things? Just to kind of get into that,
yeah,
intellectual journey of,
yeah,
it.
What a good question. Honestly, it was a bit of both. You know, I had a hunch that law was at the foundation of economic dynamics, and that we could analyze it through law without having to go through economics. We could learn from economics, of course, but that there was another way into this. And to that extent, it validated, I think, preconceived notions I already had that I just didn't have words for, or not just words, maybe you'd say a framework for. But it also blew my mind because, you know, my thinking about that was limited to say like the corporate form, business forms, contracts, you know, labor regulation. The idea that money itself could be something designed was something that, like, I hadn't even for a second thought about that. Just totally mind blowing, and thrilling in a way. It also really underlies, I think, a role for legal history in this work, which is so vital. It's not just legal history for understanding where something came from, but for understanding, you know, how it works, how it could be redesigned, how the future could change. So it really, it felt almost to me like legal history written for future-oriented thinking, which was also mind-blowing for me. I was not expecting that. And it thrilled, I mean, to this day, it's just, it's, you know, I haven't read a good novel in years because by my bedside, it's just random monetary histories. I'm just hooked, you know, 5 years, 6 years later.
Yeah. Maybe you can, for those listening who are not lawyers or law students, which is probably the majority, can you situate a little bit about the way that the mainstream legal profession and the way that orthodox law pedagogy, at least from what I know about it, largely through the law and economics movement or law and economics framework, how it normatively positions money, and why the Christine Dezan's argument that money is actually a function of legal design is such a radical departure from that mainstream ideology.
Well, I'm probably going to give a pretty unsatisfying answer because I, even though I'm American by birth, I did my law degree up in Canada, where I live now, in Toronto, at University of Toronto. And in Canada, the law and economics movements has a presence, no doubt. It has a much smaller and I think less explicitly political, or maybe not explicitly political, maybe a less politically charged presence in the legal academy here than in the States. So it's not true that it's sort of the dominant mode of thinking about core legal topics here. It's just not. It depends on where you go to school. You might land with some profs where it really is, but there's a much wider variety of approach to, say, private law topics here. And the dominance of, no, I wouldn't say wider, because these presences, because these scholars and these views are in the States as well. It's such a huge market. So that's not quite the right word, but it's less dominant here. And so for me, it wasn't an opposition to law and economics at all. Honestly, I didn't care that much about law and economics. I still don't honestly care that much about law and economics. I should probably care more about it.
I don't think anyone should.
And it's not that I don't think there's lots of problems with that orthodoxy and whatnot. There are, but at least in my opinion, I have lots of critiques of it. I've also quite appreciated some scholarship coming out of it. But it's not the dominant force here, and it wasn't what I sort of had in mind when I read Chris's work for the first time at all. You know, here, I think, you know, I went to U of T, which is University of Toronto, which is famously sort of a last bastion of legal formalism. Not last, but one of the remaining big. So I was actually taught by some formalists for my private law classes. And honestly, I'm not at all, I wouldn't call them, they're not formalists in the classical legal thought sense, but sort of a neo-formalist take. And I am not, that's not my view at all. I'm fundamentally, I think, opposed to that view, but these people were phenomenal teachers, I will tell you. They're just like, some of the formalist profs I had in the first year were some of the best profs I've had in any context anywhere. They're just so devoted to doctrine and to reading it deeply and richly and engaging with it, trying to make it rational and coherent, that they just, they really teach you private law in a way that's, I think, very impressive. So that was sort of the dominant norm when I went to law school. And that norm, I think, doesn't even think about money. We didn't talk about money. We didn't think about money. It was just, you talk about damage awards, but you don't talk about what money is or design. I don't think I read the word bank once in law school. There's no financial regulation class taught. It was just wasn't even in the sphere. So that's sort of the perspective I was coming from, probably very different than a lot of people who went to U.S. law schools, you know, in a somewhat different context.
Well, actually, that's a really satisfying answer, not only because you've kind of reframed the question and taught us more than what the question was, I think, searching for. But I think I was also trying to, fumbling and clumsily trying to just set into relief what the constitutional approach or the legal design approach to money that design is working on. I was just trying to put that into relief in with respect to other dominant forms and the kind of neo-formalism that you associate with the Toronto School where you got your degree. Maybe it doesn't have this aggressive neoclassical economics framework that we see in the law and economics movement. It nevertheless, as you're suggesting, by means of a kind of omission, is just not thinking about money at all, let alone the ways in which it is actually constitutive, to come back to your kind of frustration with labor law, the way it's constitutive of setting up frameworks for political contestation in the first place.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think I do want to make two small clarifications. I don't know if I would phrase it as my frustration with labor law, which I quite loved working in, and it was more frustration with a certain framing of labor law, which I think is too common. And then my other small correction is that, or not correction, oh yeah, it is a correction, excuse me, is that there are, for example, Lawns economics scholars, even at U of T, that tend to teach the corporate law course. But even in those courses, I don't think you say anything about money. So, I mean, you do some modeling, but, you know, or kind of model-like thinking, I would say. But so I think you're right. It was just an omission. It was like, here's this thing under our nose. It almost feels sometimes studying money to me like you're in one of these old fantasy novels I used to read as a kid, and you're like training to be, you know, a sorcerer or something. And you're reading some book that tells you how the elements work and you can manipulate them. Sometimes it feels like reading about money is almost like that. You're realizing these systems that are underneath everything we do that people just don't talk about, but they actually have, you know, mechanics and, you know, structures, and you can learn how they work, and then they can be manipulated. And it's like, you're uncovering this like magical world behind the world. So powerful. Really striking. So yeah, that was my experience. It was less opposing an orthodoxy than it was sort of realizing this hidden, you know, source of wonder, which I'm still totally caught in.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that speaks to, I mean, I'm not in the legal profession at all, but that also speaks to, I think, a lot of my feelings and experience in moving through these worlds as well. It strikes me, I'm thinking of an analogy of, you know, what it must be like to think about law without thinking about money. And it's like teaching English literature without thinking about the English language, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. how the English language is structured.
Which I think
you just sort of take.
Which I think probably is how a lot of people study English literature. They probably read a lot of novels. They never talk about the language.
Right. Right. So maybe we can pivot to your broader research at Harvard with Christine Dazan, mm-hmm. And what you're up to there, and maybe wind our way to this particular project about the Bank of the People that your law journal article is based on, and that your small little vertical piece is also giving us a taste of.
So when Professor Dazan took me on as a student, I started looking for a thesis topic, basically, while also just trying to read everything I could about monetary history. And it struck me how little was written on Canadian monetary history. And I'm not saying that nothing is written. There's some very good things written, actually. But you could probably fit every book and published article on Canadian monetary history on like one library shelf. There's probably more written about Paul Volcker personally than the entire history of Canadian money. and I'm not saying like, you know, Canadian monetary history is as important as the US or anything like that, but it's like, it's just, the discrepancy is shocking. And it's not, Canada's not an unimportant country. It's not a huge country. It was, you know, 36, 37 million people, but financially, it's a very impressive country that's always pulled above its weight, has a famously large and stable, maybe you say that's good, maybe you don't, financial system and banking sector. You know, head of Bank of Canada, was recently made head of Bank of England afterwards. Of course, talking about Mark Carney. So it's like, Canada has a pretty big presence here, and there's a real dearth of scholarship about the history of its monetary system. So I thought, okay, I live in Canada, raising my family here, love it here. I want to just, there's got to be a project in here to look at. So I just started honestly combing through, whatever I could find about Canadian monetary history and looking at where there was room for work. And the bulk of my research has ended up being about the Bank of Canada. I don't have anything published on that yet, although I have several drafts that are close and should hopefully be out soon-ish in the next year or two. But I, in terms of this particular project, I remember looking through and finding this period that the paper's about, where you're in Upper Canada. It's a colony that's more or less Ontario today. And the time right before the rebellion, the Canada Rebellion, which I presume we'll talk more about later. And there's all these banks starting with all these different notes. And I remember looking through and seeing a bank called the Bank of the People, thinking, like, what is this? And seeing an image of one of their notes and thinking, okay, there's a cool project here. I don't know what it's going to be, but I know there's something to do with law, money, politics, and social structures in this moment. And then it was just about framing the piece in a way that could capture the era in a way that was sort of accessible and in sort of a, it's not really a bite-sized paper, I wish it was, but a more bite-sized piece. Because, going into this project, it's funny, Scott, you'll once in a while see historians or high school teachers who teach in Canada doing little polls of their students, and they say, what's the first word you think of when you think of Canadian history? And you can probably guess the word that always wins. I don't know if you want to try to guess.
I don't want to even try.
Okay.
No, I'm stepping into something bad here. You
The word that always
go.
wins is boring. Always. Number one word. No, I'm not even kidding. And this is
Oh,
Canadians talking about Canadian history, right? Yeah, and
wow.
it's kind of shocking. I think most Canadians would much rather pay attention to British or American history. There's probably as many Canadian academics working on British and American history as there are Canadian. And there's so many of the works on Canadian monetary history are comparative too, dealing with, I can't tell you how many people told me I should make my projects comparative. And I just didn't want to do that. I thought, like, we deserve to have some history explicitly about this moment, but I wanted to frame it in a way that would draw on bigger debates that I'm plugged into in the States and in England and elsewhere. And so, the whole idea of the piece was, how do I write a piece that's, first off, it's Canadian history, which people already think is boring. Sadly, because it's not, but people think that it's monetary history. Not only that, it's kind of business history. And not only that, it's kind of banking business history. Like, that's like a label on the shelf of the book barn you're walking through in some small town, banking history, that you almost want to walk faster to get past it, because you think the radiation of boring coming from the shelf must just be overwhelming. So, yeah.
Can I ask you a just to pause for a
Sure.
second, just a little bit about like Canadian self-identity and ideology. Do Canadians as like a trope, do Canadians think themselves boring, or is it that their history is
Oh,
boring? I mean, is it
I'm
like
referring to the latter. I'm
totalizing?
referring to the latter. I can't speak for
Okay.
Canadians and if they think themselves. I mean, as an American who's,
Okay.
I've been here a while now, but still, I don't think Canadians think of themselves as boring, but maybe they do, maybe
Okay,
they
so it's
don't. I don't
just
know.
their history. Their history
Yes.
is for some reason really sleepy. Nothing to see here.
Yeah, which is not true, but it's how, maybe it's a symptom of how it's taught. I don't know, because I didn't grow up here. Or maybe it's a symptom of being ne next to the United States, which has, one of the most shocking and violent histories of any country in world history. I don't know. But it's true. And writing Canadian legal history, banking history, I went into this project thinking, okay, there's like 12 layers of boring on top of the first word I write in this thing, right? So everything about the project was trying to frame it in a way that's accessible to people who maybe don't care about Canadian history, maybe don't care about banking history, maybe don't care about monetary history. It was like, okay, I want it to be. That's one of the reasons it's called the Bank of the People. The real project is really about the era, not just about this bank. It was sort of the way in, because I thought, if I call this, like, bank conflict in Upper Canada, that's written for historians, right, of Upper Canada. That's a small group. if I call it Bank Wars, and there's quite a good paper called Bank War of Lower Canada, I think, or Bank Wars in Lower Canada. That's an American term. Bank War refers to Jackson's veto of the Second Bank of the United States. So I'm instantly inviting a comparative lens, borrowing an American term. And it's also a pretty specialized thing that not that many people are going to draw into. I thought, okay, if I call it the Bank of the People, it's a little bit evocative. And then I can make it almost like we're just following this one institution. So we can take this era and make it a little bit more bite-sized, have a little narrative arc, just to make it, you know, just a little bit more open. I mean, thank goodness the bank had such a cool name, and it gave me the title.
Well, certainly the institution is not without its complications from what I've learned from
Sure.
It's even its contradictions, and certainly it's, you know, part of a history of settler colonialism. Mm-hmm. It nevertheless provides a kind of inspirational hero figure.
Right.
To be thinking about a monetary future that isn't just determined by private profit exploitation and political repression.
Right. And so it was sort of the protagonist, but, you know, the theme of the paper that it meant to be was just sort of the introduction of banks and what it means to issue money from banks, you know, in many regards. And also just, it had been written about by a couple scholars, not in a ton of detail. One of them wrote it in some detail, Albert Schrowers, who I cited a few times. But he doesn't use exactly the lens I use. And even then, I thought there was also just room for some good primary source history of this institution that hadn't been done. So it was also an excuse to just get in the archives and have a good, well-researched empirical account of this moment, because there's a lot of that lacking too. So sort of the two birds, it was like, make it an interesting thing people can get into and, you know, plug some holes in the record a bit.
So I'd like to work our way toward, replaying this story that you've uncovered. But maybe before we do, I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit more about what you mentioned, your lens, right? And the kind of rhetorical dance that you're doing in this, you know, law journal article. So you're coming with what we typically refer to as an endogenous money approach, right? And the endogenous money creation approach is usually contrasted with what is sometimes called fractional reserve banking. And, you know, probably most people who are going to be listening to this show already have some sense of these terms, but we always like to, you know, provide on-ramps for listeners who are joining us for the first time. You know, we've caught their eye or ear for some reason or another. So maybe you can just unpack those two approaches and talk a little bit about how you rhetorically kind of worked an argument for the endogenous approach into this piece in a way that's enfolded into the empirical history without necessarily explicitly staging this debate for the readers.
Right, sure. I did have that perspective, so maybe I did bring it in, but I didn't mean to. I think it happened a bit iteratively. So it's a great question. One of the dilemmas with this project also, I know I'm starting out with all these things I was worried about when I wrote it.
It's great. But, it's great, because the worries aren't in the document. The worries aren't in the paper.
Yeah. So one worry I have...
This shows how, I totally empathize. This shows how thoughtful, scholarly, critical work is always, you know, it's always driven by not solutions, but a bunch of worries, a bunch of questions, a bunch of, you know, how do I frame it? And how do, you know, oh, if I say it this way, it's going to speak to that audience, but I don't want to do that.
And, yes.
But then there's the danger of doing it that way.
Oh, totally. So... one of the other worries I had about this, one was the quote unquote boring worry. The other worry was that people wouldn't see it as legal scholarship. So I think most legal history, which is, you know, what I study, is essentially social history of what we agree is a legal topic. So history, like I read a quite excellent history of workers' comp in Quebec the other day. And it's essentially a piece of social history. It's using social historical methods, not that much legal methods, although some were in there, of a topic we agree is law already. You know, think about history of, you know, an aspect of family law, or all the histories written of, for example, abortion, which we accept our legal history because of all the law and the case law and the profound politics around that, particularly in the U.S. right now. The really tragic, I think, law and politics around that in the U.S. right now. So, but, you know, most people, I think, at least in the Canadian Legal Academy, don't or didn't think about money and banks as a legal thing. Financial regulation, sure. But money and the architecture of money and banks, not so much. And monetary history, definitely not. So I had to, I think, you know, convince the journal, thankfully I did, that it's law. And then that meant that my framing couldn't really be, okay, here's some debates in monetary history. For example, the endogenous credit debate versus the fractional reserve banking debate. So I had to frame it really, I think, much more generally, just as this is legal history. And you'll see how money comes out of it and how banking comes out of it. And that, but as I was doing it, all these moments happened that directly confront so many of these debates that we're having today in the issues around money and banking. One of them, as you said, is the fractional reserve versus endogenous credit debate, which is very heated right now. And this, honestly, I wasn't trying to work it into the story. I was just looking at these early charters and these, you know, legislative debates over chartering these early banks. And they're quite explicit that these banks are meant to create money. They're meant to create a medium of exchange. That's the point. They did talk about attracting capital, but they don't talk very much about intermediation. And they think of these banks as replacing the government issued notes that had taken place before them, called the army bills, which I assume we'll talk about in a bit. So it almost just happened in the materials. And I thought, well, I can't ignore this. It's a part of the story. I have to put it in there. And I always think it's disingenuous when an author tries to be neutral on a position they're not neutral on. And I have a position on this. So it's like, okay, I'm going to put it in there. I'm going to say my position, but I'm not going to frame it as, okay, here's this debate that we're having in this monetary sphere, because that would just, I think, throw off the pacing and the framing of the piece too much. So it was all about sort of working these things into the subtext of the piece in a way that was honest, you know, empirically verifiable, but also not skirting the debates that I feel very plugged into, very passionate about being had today about money. Another one was the legal tender laws, you know, monetizing foreign coin, which we might talk about, because that's a debate you hear on, you know, MMT Twitter all the time about the Mexican dollar. You know, how can money be credit created by government if the Mexican dollar is being used all over? Well, maybe they made laws saying it could be used. I wasn't looking for that. I had no idea that was there, right? It was just like, oh, look, this is... why is money working this way? Well, there's a law. It says it works this way. Pretty miraculous. So yeah, I think you're right to point out a lot of the subtext of the piece is trying to, or does reference contemporary debates. And I think it was less me going into the project with those in mind than me finding them and thinking, well, then this has to be part of the narrative. I can't avoid it.
So just to spell out that debate a little mm-hmm. bit more, on the
I didn't answer your question today.
Again, just to onboard some listeners who are less familiar. Do you want to take it on?
Why don't you start us off?
Well, I think we've implied a lot that the approach that is the approach of this podcast, mm-hmm, the approach mm-hmm. of Christine Dazan, the approach that I think we share is the endogenous creation approach, which sees money as a creature of law. That that understands banks as essentially a state agents or franchisees that actually actively issue money on behalf of the government all the time. So the way I often like to talk about it is that from an orthodox point of view, money printing is a perversion. It's something it's something that happens either when somebody is doing something that they shouldn't be doing, or in response to an emergency, but in either case, something is wrong. Whereas I think the endogenous money approach says, no, you know, money printing is the norm. I mean, money printing in a kind of expansive sense of just money creation. Money is being created all the time. It's being created through legislation, and it's being created through legislation that charters banks, that delegates the power for money creation through these banks, usually for private purposes and private profit, and creating systems of often unjust indebtedness. But that's not how most people think about banks.
Right.
Most people think about banks according to this fractional reserve theory of how banking works. Do you want to take that on?
Sure. So, I mean, I think you said basically what I would say. I would maybe differ a little bit in a few details. I think you can probably be an endogenous credit person and not be a money as a legal institution person full bore like you and I are. Although I think you're completely correct. I think you can also probably be an endogenous money person and not be banks as franchisees of the state person, although I think that's a more tenuous position. But I agree, group all of those. And you're completely right that, you know, there's a certain orthodox position that does see money printing as a perversion. I wouldn't say it's completely the mainstream, but there's a chunk of it. I recently read Dror Goldberg's new book on the Massachusetts bills credit that were printed called Easy Money. And that's absolutely his view. The whole thing is just replete with inflation is theft. Money printing by the government is a perversion. How is it that it works? Isn't it horrible that it works? It's also modern and amazing. He's kind of fascinated by it, but he hates it. It's a very ideologically driven book and really expresses that view, I think, that you put forth here. Yeah, so, but you know, more generally speaking, my understanding is that both fractional reserve banking folks and endogenous credit folks agree that banks create money. I think the distinguishing thing is fractional reserve people think of banks creating money as essentially a form of intermediation. It's almost accidental to their existence. It's just a form of credit they issue. And what they really do is intermediate. And this is tied in with key views of development, I think, economic development in general, which often refer to Northam Weingast's famous article from the 80s about credible commitment, that, you know, once we credibly commit to the market, get government out of the way, people will start to loan and trust intermediaries, and you'll have money moving around and you'll have growth. And I'm way oversimplifying, but that's, you know, more or less the view. And then, of course, there's a endogenous credit view, which sees money creation, creating a medium of exchange, as essential to what banks do, as the reason they're chartered, the reason they're brought in, and their defining feature. So that's what makes banks different than, say, an insurance company. And it's why banks maybe need different regulation than an insurance company. You know, an insurance company or a pure savings bank, one that doesn't create liabilities through lending, those are actual pure intermediaries. Versus a bank, what's special about a bank is not just that it intermediates, which clearly it does through payment system and other ways, but is that it creates a medium of exchange. This is the defining feature. And this gives it, in our view, and I think this is quite right, a public role. Whether or not you think it's a franchisee of the state, it's doing a public thing. It's providing a public service. And this is always my, this I think is the really exciting debate around SVB right now. You know, another exciting debate is about deposit insurance. That's a specific debate. I have less of an opinion on that. I'm much more interested in this idea that, like, is there any such thing as a bank that's too big to fail, or are they all too big to fail because they're utilities? They're providing a public service. You know, a power company that goes insolvent for bad business isn't allowed to unplug its customers. It doesn't matter if it serves a town of 10,000 or the state of California. Why do we think that banks, if they are run poorly in business, should be able to just unplug people from the money and payment system? That seems absurd to me when you realize that the defining feature of banks is creating our money. And the history here was really telling to me because I had no idea about this before I went into it, but they were explicitly chartered, at least in Canada, to take on that role. It was, you know, government used to do this. Government's not going to do it anymore. And we're going to charter these banks to do it for particular colonial political reasons. So it was striking to me that the history so well matched what I see banks doing today, the role that they're asked to play. And so I think you're right. I think there's so much of this history that I think underpins the endogenous credit view throughout. It's pretty stunning.
I want to ask a clarifying question before we, well, then I promise we'll plunge into the history that you've uncovered. So the fractional reserve literature, I guess what I was doing was playing fast and loose, moving between the term fractional reserve banking and its literature and kind of popular ideological assumptions about what banks do, right? That the banks have no money, they collect deposits, and then they lend them out at interest, right? And that essentially banking works the way that they work in Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
So I was playing a little fast and loose there, but I have a technical question about the fractional reserve banking literature, which is, you said the literature acknowledges that banks create credit, but does fractional reserve theory technically, does it technically deem all money credit or a credit debt instrument or relation, or does it have a different, let's say, ontological construction of what money is that then structures the way that they think about credit bank lending?
Right. Well, I you would probably know this better than me. I think you're more plugged into the econ theory literature than I am. But my impression is there is a different view of money and credit. The fractional reserve banking view is built on an idea that there is such a thing as money. It's constructed socially, not through law, and it's the base money supply. Government can get involved later regulating it. You know, let's say it starts as coin. Government can get involved requiring the coin have certain content, quality. It can simplify the process of making exchange with metal by minting coin and having a set amount stamped on it. And then credit is built on top of that. Credit is a promise to pay money. Credit is not money itself. Of course, the legal view fundamentally disagrees. I mean, our view, which I know you agree with, is that all money is credit. Not all credit is money, but all money is credit. And it's just a form of credit. It depends on the issuer and the terms. Some credit satisfies a claim or an exchange immediately. Some does not. So you can have money and promises to pay money all be credit at different levels with different instructions. It's just looking at, you know, the legal foundations of the specific credit arrangement and how it's created. And you can have credit that's, you know, maybe explicitly money. It's used as a medium of exchange. It's used to satisfy debts, whatever. Or you can have credit that's explicitly not money. That's, you know, a broader promise to pay money or promise to exchange or redeem or something like that. Is that what you're getting at in terms of the?
Yeah, deals? That's really yeah. clarifying. And I just think that these discussions are really helpful. I'm glad I asked. Yeah. And I'm glad we expanded that out. So now, let's talk about this history. And I think I'd like to start at the beginning in two senses. I want to start at the beginning of the paper itself, just for a beat. And then we'll go back to the sort of the beginning of the history, because you don't actually start at the beginning of the history in the paper and just in the name of Canadian history, okay, not being boring. I want to read the first line of your paper.
Sure.
On his march into Toronto during the Upper Canada Rebellion of 1837, already not bored, rebel leader, what is this, Star Wars? William... Is it Leon or Lion?
Well, that's how it's Lion. Pronounced. I don't know if it's how it's pronounced then, but today people can't say William Lyon.
Okay. Rebel leader William Lyon Mackenzie paused the march, forced himself into the home of a bank teller named Dr. Robert Charles Horn, and burned the house to the ground. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's where you start.
Yes.
And then basically from there, you kind of tease out the context, and then you take us back to to the beginnings of how we get there. So do you want to kind of take us on this journey? What is that situation, and then how does it bring you back to this earlier moment?
Yeah, I thought this was a great my early drafts didn't have an anecdote in the beginning, and then actually Professor Dizon suggested I work an anecdote into it, but I wanted it to be really short, so I thought, like, what can I put in a sentence that captures the moment? And then I was reading about the rebellion, and this is the first piece of property destroyed in the rebellion. There was a whole case afterwards about compensating the family for it. And I thought, like, okay, that's it. You know, because why are you going to pick that house You're walking into town, you're trying to conduct a rebellion, you're worried about them getting the soldiers to stop you along the way. And, you know, why are you going to break into this guy's house? And I think he killed the guy's dog, too, and scared the family out of the house.
Oh, boy.
The place. So, yeah, it was not a pretty scene. I thought it was because he hated this guy. This guy would never give him a loan, and he hated the guy's institution. You know, the Bank of Upper Canada was, you know, if not target number one, maybe target number two or three in the eyes of the rebel group at the time, because it just represented everything undemocratic about Upper Canada's social order. And so, you know, when you learn this history, this detail is included in Histories of the Rebellion, but it seems odd. It stands out because I think they're not paying enough attention to the banking dynamics and the politics around banking that led up to that moment. So it's sort of, why aren't we trying to make sense of why he chose this guy, why he chose this guy's house? We should be. And I think it underlines how much money in banking was a key part of the reformer movement at that time and political debate in Upper Canada at that time, period. So that was sort of the lead-in with the work, you know, the question posed.
Great. So then you pull us back to, I mean, there's no absolute starting point, but you choose a starting point. So what's the starting point? What's the situation in Canadian monetary history that then will lead us to this moment?
Great. You know, so actually, I might even start a little earlier than the paper starts with you.
Go for it.
You know, funny, you grew up in the States, you learn about the American Revolution ad nauseum, right? Like, it's repeated every year in school. And it's amazing to me how little attention is paid to all the British colonies that weren't part of the revolution, right? Think about all the colonies in the Caribbean that maybe had their own independent struggles, their own rebellions, and the colonies to the north as well that would eventually become Canada. We just don't pay any attention to them in the States. It's almost like they're not even part of the scene until later. And it's amazing to me. There was this colony called Quebec at the time of the American Revolution, or Quebec, that stretched literally from the American Midwest to, I think, Labrador, or today's what Labrador on the ocean, just absolutely massive chunk of land. And after the revolution, what England does is they decide to settle loyalists in this area. So they pass a statute, which we today call, and at the time they called, the Constitution Act, 1794, I think. And it takes this giant colony called Quebec and splits it up. So you get Upper Canada on the west and Lower Canada on the east. Upper Canada supposedly refers to the fact that it's up the St. Lawrence River. But I don't know if that's really the basis of it, but that's what they say. So this story takes place in Upper Canada, which England settles with basically loyalists and indigenous groups that have fought on England's side in the revolution. And that's the early, say, Western settler establishment of Upper Canada, today Ontario, and Toronto is the capital. And that's the setting for this story. What they do, there's an explicit attempt to create a pro-monarchy elite in Upper Canada. You know, to keep it loyal and for other reasons. And the politics of the era are very much framed around that. There are new immigrants and other groups who are in favor of a more democratic order. Very few are advocating for a Republican order. There are some, but very few. Mackenzie is one of them, and he's even a bit flighty on it. But there are people advocating for a more democratic order in Upper Canada, and those advocating for a more aristocratic order. And it's typically framed all around the British constitutional values, or sort of the framing, at least among the settler population. So there are groups by this era, which we call the reformers, who are saying, and reformer is a bit of a fudgy term. They referred to each other as reformers, but they weren't really a formal political party. They were sort of a loose grouping, and there were more radical members and more moderate members. But for the most part, and I presume we'll say more about them in a minute, for the most part, the reformers were advocating for a more democratic order along the lines of what you had in England. So they would have called for what they called responsible government, which would get instituted somewhat in 1841 and more after Confederation in 1867. That's when Canada dates its founding. And then you had the other group who were might be referred to as conservatives or Tories, who were in favor of a more aristocratic order, maybe even having explicitly an elite, you know, a gentry in Upper Canada. And then they're also not really a formal political party, and they have groups within them. And the most vehement and notorious today is referred to as the Family Compact, This was a group of arch-conservatives, you might call them, organized around a bishop named John Strawn. It's a street still named after him in Ontario, or in Toronto. And he spelled Strachan, but pronounced Strawn. And he organized this group literally to establish sort of an undemocratic, pro-monarchial British order in Upper Canada, at least as he saw it, in opposition to the reformers, in opposition to the United States. And the fight between those two was really the dominant political fight in Canada as of the 1830s, and a bit in the 20s.
Do you know where the name Family Compact comes from?
Yeah.
Why family?
William Lyon Mackenzie came up with it. He was one of the more radical reformers. I don't remember exactly what he referred to, but it was kind of...
So it's a pejorative.
It is. But it's adopted by historians today completely.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Pejorative come up by the reformers that just stuck. Mackenzie is one of these wild characters who, one of the other dilemmas of this paper, I keep talking about dilemmas, was making him not play too big a role. Because, he wasn't the main reformer. He burned down that house. He led the rebellion. But he wasn't the only or the main reformer involved in the Bank of the People or in the reform movement generally. He was a huge figure. But he has such a larger-than-life role in this era. And he just wrote so much that, when you're doing history, you're just looking for things to read and sources, and there's so few preserved from that era in Canadian history, that he just wrote so much that it's really hard not to let him just dominate almost anything you write, because all the good quotes come from, he had a great turn of phrase, all the good quotes come from William Lyon Mackenzie. So a big dilemma in this paper also was just trying to keep him in his place, something he's never been very good at, staying in his place. So that was the framing. It was very much a post-American Revolution settlement and tension over what the British constitutional order required and called for in this colony called Upper Canada. We have to remember, it wasn't Canada yet, right? It was several British colonies that would be grouped as Canada later. So this is very much an Upper Canada story with reference to Lower Canada. The two were integrated in a lot of ways. And it was a tension over what the structure of the political order in this colony should be post-American Revolution.
So then clearly there is a structure of monetary issuance and a structure of monetary politics that weaves its way through this this historical moment. Can you talk about what that looks like, which is rather messy?
Yeah, very messy. So England was never keen on its colonies issuing their own money, ever. But, they had gotten away with it a few times. Massachusetts had bills of credit a couple times, briefly had a mint. But after the American Revolution, which was funded, of course, with printing bills of credit, the continental dollar, there was absolutely no way England was going to let its colonies print their own money, right? It was on lockdown. And not only that, but as of 1820s, England really wanted all of its colonies not to rely on American or Spanish units of account. They wanted everything in sterling. They just wanted, money is governance. If you can print money, you can hire people to rebel or do whatever you want. And so if you want to lock down a colony, the first thing you need to do is lock down their money. At least that was the view. So there was a pretty strict limit on the colonies doing anything, passing any bills to allow any kind of money issuance, with some exceptions, as we'll talk about one in a second. So this was a dilemma for the colonies, because they're given almost a contradictory mandate. The state says grow, exploit, conquer. These are things colonies do. And the state being the mother state in Europe, it's also saying you can't issue money to hire people to do any of these things. It's also saying, and extract lots of goods that you sell to us, so you're going to have a negative balance of trade, so your money is going to continually come back to England too. So it's putting colonies, and of course, I'm not trying to glorify colonial expansion at all, but it's putting them in a contradictory position, let's say that. And so what colonies did typically, and this actually started well before Upper Canada, this started in, I believe Massachusetts was the first colony to do this, they started monetizing foreign coin, because there just wasn't enough British coin around. So what they would do is they would pass laws. In Upper Canada, they were typically called the Currency Act. At least that's how people would refer to them. The titles of the laws are a bit longer. And the Currency Act would do a very interesting thing. It would say, okay, the unit of account in our colony is sterling is the pound. But all of these coins are legal tender. And legal tender here typically meant, legal tender usually just means it can be used to satisfy a court debt. But here, legal tender was often paired with tax receivability. So it would say, the actual language they would use is they'd say, these currencies pass current. And then it would say, which means they are legal tender and can be used to satisfy any public debts. Or it would say they can be used to satisfy any debts, public and private. Phrasing like that. So it was, you know, a full package. You'd get tax receivability, you'd be legal tender status. And then it would list varieties of coin. You know, French coin, Spanish coin. The Spanish silver dollar was the most common coin in the Americas at the time. This is due to Spanish colonial expansion in South America and the finding of Potosi in Peru and the sheer amount of silver they got out of it and mint operations in Mexico. There's a whole huge, rich, amazing history of money there, which there's some great work being done about as well. And so they would monetize Spanish coin, for example, British coin, American coin, and then they would rate it according to, they would say, hey, this coin is worth this many sterling. And the rating system was not correlated to the actual content of metal in the coin, which is a good thing. So if you don't have mints, it's actually very hard to tell how much metal is in a given coin. So it would be very hard for them to correspond it to. And then it would even rate British coin higher than its actual face value. And the idea of this was to retain coin in the colony. So if coin is worth more here than in French colonies or in Spanish colonies or in England, then maybe people will keep it here because they'll be able to buy more goods with it. So this was called overrating. So they would deliberately overrate foreign coin in order to attract it, and they would deliberately monetize it by law. And colonies had done this. I've also talked to some other scholars. Spanish colonies did similar things. There was less need. Caribbean colonies did similar things. This was not just a Canadian story at all. The American colonies did this. Something I didn't know about before I embarked on this project. Yeah, it was, you know, an explicit monetization of foreign coin, which also, I think, really interestingly, drew a firm line between the unit of account, so in this case, sterling, and the actual medium of exchange people used. So there was very little British coin around, and even British coin that was around was worth more than what it said on his face. So your medium of exchange was almost completely divorced from how prices were listed. So this is why in papers they wouldn't refer to it actually as sterling, they would refer to it as Halifax currency. That refers to the index. The index is the list of values of different coins corresponding to sterling. And it was called the Halifax currency because Halifax was in Nova Scotia, is the city they first used that index or a version of it. There were different varieties of it in different colonies at different times. They would update the law every 5 or 6 years or something to change the values or to remonetize coin or to get rid of demonetized coin. And there was also called the York rating, which is actually named for New York City, where it was adopted. York rating was a dollar-based rating. Halifax currency was a sterling-based rating. But in either case, at least in the Halifax case, it didn't really refer to English sterling, right? That's why you would call it Halifax currency, because British coin was actually worth a different amount, in Canada than in England. So it was just a complete break between unit of account and medium of exchange, anchored by the colonial arrangements and the legal arrangements that established it.
Great. Yeah, it's fascinating. I guess we could talk about the exception that you referred to a moment ago.
Sure. So the universal exception with money issuance is always war. It seems to be the one moment that everyone agrees our typical rules about money should go out the window and we should change everything, at least till the war's over. And so in Canadian history, this was the War of 1812. This is another funny thing for me. You know, growing up in the States, I was taught that the U.S. won the War of 1812. Everyone here is taught that Canada won the War of 1812. the answer is, of course, in the middle. So to fund the War of 1812, hard thing to do without money, at least without sufficient money. So the British military and the colonies teamed up and they issued these things called army bills. They were anchored in colonial legislation, but they were issued by the army office. It was very much a colonial cooperation between, you know, the mother country and the colony. And they issued these army bills. They were essentially bills of credit. They were, they were issued in very small denominations. Some would be bigger, mostly small denominations, so people could use them for trade. They were legal tender. In fact, the law said they should be accepted as if specie. Specie is just a word for a coin. In all payments, public and private. So they were you weren't allowed to distinguish between them and coin, an actual coin. They were usually listed in dollars, although sometimes sterling and sometimes both. And they were also receivable, technically. So you could go to an Army bill office and exchange your bill for coin. So if you had a one, say, dollar note, you could exchange it for a dollar's worth of coin, of legal tender coin. It doesn't say what kind. So you don't necessarily get an American dollar. You don't necessarily get some pence or sterling. A piece of eight. What you get is whatever combination of legal tender money they can give you. It could also be exchanged for bills of exchange callable on England. We don't have to talk about those if you don't want. That's a bit complicated. Yeah, it's fine. For the most part, I mean, I'd love to later, but for this narrative, maybe it's a bit too afield. So for the most part, though, they were not redeemed. For the most part, they were used for as a medium of exchange and for tax payments, and that's how they were wound up after the war. They were very well received. There's lots of stories of attempts to issue a paper money in colonies and populations not taking to it. A lot of these stories in Latin America, for example. Canada, at least Upper Canada, was very much the exception. The population was very keen on a paper money. They adopted it immediately. There's lots of discourse from the time talking about how great the army bills are and how they've allowed growth and exchange. War is never a fun thing, and things to fund war are not fun things. But it's amazing how positive the discourse was about the army bills in spite of that. And it really was. After the war, though, you know, England is still worried about independence of these colonies and governance control, so they wind up the money. They redeem the entire issue. It was an amount of money, I'm forgetting the actual number, I have it in my paper, an amount of liquidity that the colony wouldn't have until the 1850s, ever again. So the benefits of it were shocking to people, and the winding up of it was also shocking to people. It was just a huge monetary contraction, and people were not very keen on it. There was a lot of opposition to it, and it was a deeply unpopular move, but it went through. And
do you know what the mechanisms were to affect that total redemption? Was it just holding on to tax payments and fees and fines and just not reissuing?
I believe that was primarily, although I need to do more research in this. I think there was some use for redeeming land claims as well, post-war, but I need to do more research on that. But from what I know, it was mostly, we're not issuing anymore. You can use them to pay taxes. When you do, they get shredded, which is a typical practice with bills of exchange. You don't want them reissued, so they come for taxes and they get shredded or burned. I'm saying shredded, but I think burned is the right answer. And so, yeah, that was the...
They didn't have electric shredders back then. No.
Figuratively speaking.
So we have this moment of monetary abundance, which is key to war, unfortunately, something we see again and again in modern history. There's this intense contraction and public unhappiness and unrest. And so how do the powers that be respond to this dearth of liquidity after the retirement, the redemption of all these bills of credit?
So one thing I should have said, too, is that a lot of times I think it's hard for us to think of how difficult a world with a lack of liquidity can be. And I think in the particularly in the early modern era in Europe, and in this is well within the modern era here, it's worth taking a moment to think about what it means if you're low on liquidity. In this environment, what it typically means is a lot of purchases on personal credit. So the way I like to think of it is like those old TV shows where somebody goes to the bar and they're about to settle up and the bartender says, you know, you owe me $10. And the customer says, I put it on my tab. And then, you know, you'll settle up eventually. Imagine a world where there's tons and tons of purchases based on people's tabs because you don't have sufficient money. And then someone gets paid. You know, maybe they get their salary, or maybe they, you know, make a sale. And then it's deciding, do I have enough money to repay all these people? How much do I have? Who do I repay first? What were the terms of our exchange? It leads to a world of a lot of arguing over who remembers exactly the amount that it was, because a lot of stuff is written down, a lot of litigation. And this is a world with debt slavery. So if you're in debt to somebody and you get prosecuted, you could go to jail for this. So it's a really dire situation when you run low on liquidity in an environment like this. And it's worth, I think, picturing what life would be like with that. You know, who's going to accept my promise to pay so I can go buy whatever I need today? And who's not? And what are the terms? And it's, you know, who do I owe today? It's a complicated, messy world to live in. And then especially when, you know, these debts are settled with coin from all these different countries, valued at different amounts. It's just, I think you can just picture what a mess exchange must have been. And then what a boon having this unified currency. You know, these bills of credit, these army bills, say their value on their face, right? It says it's worth a pound, it's worth a pound. I'm not negotiating or parsing the value. What a benefit that would have been to people. It would have seemed just, you know, so much of your life just simpler and more accountable, less risky. And then to wind that up, you can see. So the government is not going to let the colonies issue their own bills of credit. It eventually does. In the 1850s, the then colony called Province of Canada, which is a united Upper Lower Canada colony later, gets to print its own bills, and then Canada itself prints its own bills in the 1870s. But at that time, Britain was not going to let the colonies print their own bills. It was not going to let army bills or something like it stick around. Government note issuance was not going to happen. But people wanted liquidity. So England says, okay, we're going to charter banks. Banks can issue paper money. That money will replace the army bills. And we're going to approve bank charters issued to essentially loyalist elite groups, so we can keep a lock on it. So we're going to keep a lock on our colonies. We're going to let you issue new money. And we're doing it through basically the corporate charter of a bank, as opposed to through a public issue. And all the banks, all the early banks in Canada, get their first charters in exactly this period, right after the War of 1812. The first, I believe, is the Bank of New Brunswick. The first bank in the Canadian colonies, Upper Lower Canada, is the Bank of Upper Canada, who we'll probably talk about in a minute. Bank of Montreal was formed slightly before it, chartered slightly later. Scotiabank, I believe, was early. So these banks all start in exactly this period. And if you look at their charters and their corporate purposes, it's explicitly to provide, it's two things. It's a lot of things, but the two big things that you take away is to provide liquidity, because the army bills have been wound up, and two, to provide a unified currency. So to clean up the sort of messy exchange of lots of different coins from different jurisdictions that we're not sure what they're worth. So, you know, if instead all that coin is stashed at a bank and a bank issues a note that says £5, and someone comes in to exchange £5 for coin, they're going to get a mess of whatever coin adds up to £5. But in the meantime, they could use that note for exchange, and it's worth what it says on its face. So it has that simplicity that the army bills offered that people really lacked and wanted. And so the banks were called in explicitly to play this, what I think of as a very public role, step in where government had proceeded. So, you know, the adoption of paper money in Canada was a public thing originally. And then only when it was wound up did we get privately issued paper monies.
So maybe you can speak to the more specific, let's say, dominant function of these banks that really does express the kind of it's a win for the endogenous money camp, right?
Yeah.
Because the, as you point out in your paper, the main role of these banks was to create credit, to create liquidity in a very non-democratic way, not to primarily serve as a depository institution, for example. I don't know if there's more to say about that structure.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the banks were referred to as banks of issue, discount, and deposit. That was the phrase. And that was to distinguish them from a savings bank. A savings bank is a true savings institution. We get a public savings bank in Canada right after Confederation. And the idea was, you know, sure, they take deposits, but deposits were an astoundingly small part of their business. For the most part, their business was built around discounting, which had a couple different meanings at the time, and money issuance. So here's how it would typically work. Say you're a merchant, and that was a common source of business for banks at the time. So you're a merchant and you need a loan to maybe make some purchases, which for things you're then going to sell at a profit. You go to a bank and you would give them a promissory note, essentially a loan. It would be on a physical piece of paper, but it wouldn't be exchangeable with other people. And the term promissory note can also refer to banknotes. So it's a lot of times there's repeat terms here that can make it very confusing. But, you know, you would give them a kind of promissory note, which would say, I will repay you this money in 6 months. And the exchange would typically be described as a sale. So you're, the bank is essentially buying a promissory note from you with their own notes or with their own credit. So the promissory note says, I'm going to pay you, you know, $1,000 plus 2% interest in 6 months. And then the bank would credit the person's account for $1,000. And often it was dollars. They it wasn't simply pounds. Often banknotes were denominated in dollars. Usually both, but often the accounts were listed in dollars. And then if you decided to draw down on your account, the bank would give you notes instead of specie. Not coin. And then the notes were also called promissory notes. The notes would say you can take them to the bank to exchange for coin at any time. And they would be listed typically in small denominations. There was lots of argument that banks should only issue larger denominations for lots of reasons. A little different than that debate happened in the States too, and it was slightly differently charged in Canada, but it would come up, but it never went anywhere. They always issued small notes. Which people then typically didn't exchange for specie. People would typically use those notes just in exchange with other people in the area. And anyone who was within range of the bank knew that that note was anchored to that monetary value because they could, you know, readily exchange it. And so the notes typically exchanged, at least it's really hard for me to track if they were exchanged at a discount, if people, you know, would accept a note, a £1 note for slightly less than a pound because it was a note and not a coin. But from my knowledge, I think they were exchanged mostly at par, as long as you're within range of the bank. And these notes super quickly start becoming the dominant medium of exchange in the colony. There's, I don't have any hard numbers, but we have accounts. I quote one of them in the paper of a government official saying these notes are used for basically all payments within, you know, 3-4 years of the banks being established. So well before 1820, these notes are the dominant money in the colony. They've almost completely replaced coin and the army bills have been phased out. So they are the dominant money. It's all issued by these private organizations that literally put their names on the notes as well. So everyone's walking around with private money in their pockets. Explicitly by that point.
So I want to raise this question that is political, but it's also a little strangely metaphysical too.
Oh, great.
Which is obviously these big publicly chartered private banks are royalist and serving largely repressive functions, even as they are answering liquidity crises and the need for more regularity and uniformity when it comes to monetary payments and payment systems. But I'm wondering about what the implications are for thinking about the nature of profit when we recognize that these institutions are in, as you put it, right? They're creating the unit. They're creating the credit that then will be paid back to them, right? Which, you know, in kind of MMT parlance, like the currency issuer doesn't need the units as if it's a finite thing that it's hemorrhaging and needs back. What it needs is the circuit of obligation to be completed or to be regularly closed, right? Issuance and redemption, right? That's what keeps things going. So what does that do for profit for an entity that technically doesn't even need it, right? And I guess what I would say is that this really puts a lot of pressure on, I don't know if you would agree, but on labor theories of value, where the idea is that sort of profit or surplus value is the result of kind of labor time being expropriated and consumed and enjoyed by others that didn't do the work, right? And so what I'm seeing in this historical situation is not that this is a just structure or that it's in any way democratic or should be defended, but rather that it's bringing out the fact that what matters more is less some kind of phantom surplus value that's being extracted, and more what the structure of issuance and obligation and redemption is even in the first place. Because the profiteers can make their own credit. They don't actually need the profit so much as the political legal structure of subordination and indebtedness, which is really just serving these royalist politics.
Right.
Does that make some sense?
It does. I mean, your comments, and I'm again, I think it's going to be a somewhat unsatisfying answer because I'm much less plugged into these debates than you. I'm not a Marxist, right? But what your comments make me think of, I'm going to share two thoughts. One is, a frustration I have with a lot of, not all, Marxist scholarship is its focus on production and surplus value. And when I look at these colonial monetary arrangements, it's not that they don't want profit and gain and growth, because they clearly do. They talk about it. But more than that, they want control, and they talk about it constantly. It's just a constant in discourse of the era is governance and control around money. And that's not always necessarily about profit. You know, is it control is a way to get profit, or is it, you know, maybe using the profit motive as a way to put certain people in positions of control and governance? And I think it's much more the latter. It's both. It's always both. But I think the emphasis in the sources is much more on the latter. And it's one reason that I think maybe I'm not drawn so much to Marxist scholarship in this area, because I think the focus when you get into the materials is much more on control than it is on, say, production or value or surplus value or anything like that. Of course, it's always both. Lots of gray area, but at least that's my tendency. The other thing your comment made me think of is a recent Twitter debate. We're going a bit afield here. I hope that's okay.
It's beautiful.
Around the SVB failure. And, Peter Conte Brown, who's a scholar that I disagree with him a lot, and I quite respect him, love his book, recommend anybody read it. He took issue with an editorial written by Lev Menand and Morgan Ricks, who I'm sure you know. They both written great books also. Morgan, I think, wrote one of the modern classics, I would call it, The Money Problem. They describe in their editorial in the Washington Post, I think it was, describe banks as public franchisees, borrowing language from a paper by Saleh and Bob Hackett. And they, in that, Peter Conte Brown responds to that, and I believe what he said in Twitter, he said something like, they're confusing an is and an ought, that they think money should be public, therefore they're describing it as public, but really money is always a public-private partnership. I think he's got it exactly backwards there, at least in my take. I think actually it's not an ought, it's an is. We're saying money is a public thing. Everyone uses it, everyone needs it. When you task banks with doing it, that you're tasking them to do a public role, even if it's a public-private arrangement, which is clearly what the early banks in Canada were, you're asking them to play a public role to provide a bit of infrastructure. So the idea of calling banks public, calling bank money public, it's an is, it's not an ought. And the reason I say it's not an ought is because in this era and in earlier eras, you'll have lots of talk about, like, the early discourse around the Bank of England is a great example of this. All those pamphlets then, they're all describing money as public, fundamentally. And they're saying, hey, it's a public thing, but the profit motive is a great way to do this public thing. So they're explicitly saying, you know, there the is, money is public, but the ought doesn't mean it should be run by the state. In fact, they think profit motive is a great way to run this thing, better than if it was run right by the state. So I think he's got the position, at least in my perspective, exactly backwards. It's, we have to see money as public. I don't really see how you could read these sources and not take that away. And banks should money as well. I think you have to see banks as playing a public role. Now, whether you think they should be therefore democratically accountable, accountable to the quote-unquote market, or, you know, run through a profit motive or not, that's the broader debate that we can have after. That's disputable. The thing I think is maybe more essential to the discourse is seeing them as public in the first instance.
I'm going to take us just a tiny bit further afield, just because your second point that I also obviously agree with reminds me of the anonymous peer review process behind the publication of my scholarly monograph, Declarations of Dependence, Money Aesthetics and the Politics of Care. And one of the readers, I think, you know, notorious reader two, one of their big complaints was precisely this is-ought balance or question. And I think they put it in terms of normative versus utopian, but essentially in trying to describe what their concerns were, you know, the reviewer said, you know, this is an interesting exploration of the possibilities of, you know, public fiscal politics, but it's, you know, and it's utopian possibilities that could happen in the future, but that's not really how things work,
right?
That's not normatively how they work. So, for people who have read my book or are going to read my book, that's why the last paragraph, I believe, of my introduction is all about addressing this question. Is this an is or an odd? And I say outright, this is deeply is. You know, it's not a question. It's not a question of ought. So I guess I think it's interesting that even in the humanities, when thoughtful, you know, well-trained scholars, but not trained in endogenous money, when they are confronted with these alternative ideas, they immediately reach for that is-ought distinction to try to kind of temper the radical implications of the endogenous money approach. And it's just, I guess I would say that the Conte Brown and then this anonymous reviewer, like they're both expressing homologous kind of symptomatic reactions to this approach that I find just like really interesting, and the fact that they resonate with one another like that. But let's get back to the tale that we're weaving here. Obviously royalist banks, you know, serving control, serving debt peonage, serving all kinds of kind of terrible things. And so now we can come back to, I would think, the reformers.
Sure.
And the story of resistance and kind of monetary imaginations in and around and in response to these anti-democratic institutions.
Yeah, well, I think it's worth saying right off that a lot of the reformers were also absolutely royalist and loyalist, and saw themselves as British, not American. They would, some of them would use the word republic in a disparaging way. So it was not, and my first draft was like this, and I had to be educated in Upper Canadian Monetary History rather harshly by a really great scholar professor, who thankfully, I'm really glad he did it. It was really about, there was a lot of variety within the reformer camp. But also, the reformers were not these sort of pro-US, pro-democracy activists opposing the monarchy in all forms. It was much more of a debate within the British monarchical tradition, or British constitutional tradition, I should say, over, you know, what's the best expression of that? You know, you have responsible government in England. Why don't we have it here? Isn't that ridiculous? That was really the primary, I'd say, the unifying position of the reformers at the time. Banks weren't their maybe number one political campaign, but they were up there. The number one is probably the clergy reserves, which was sort of how you share land between various church groups. Churches were very much political organizing bodies in Upper Canada at the time. If you read Francis Hincks, he was one of the founder of the banks. If you read his biography, he's very explicit about this. And he says, you know, the Methodists would do this and the Anglicans would do that. And so the clergy reserves was maybe the number one hot topic, that and democratic constitutional reform, democratic reform. But then probably second tier, very top, would be banks and money, because they hated this arrangement with the private banks. You know, to bring back to our Peter Conte Brown comment just a second ago, all sides in this discourse, the conservatives, the reformers, everybody, the Family Compact and the radicals, everybody would have seen these banks as public agents, as playing a public role. The dominant theory of the corporation at the time was of the corporation as a public delegate. These were all chartered corporations. And everybody saw them as public agents doing a public thing. So the is, everybody was agreed that the is that this is a public thing we're debating. The political opposition was really as the ought. The reformers thought a public money issuance was the way to go. They thought the army bills were great. The government should issue something similar if they can get away with it. And if not, they should do something much more democratically accountable. And they hated the idea of chartering private companies to issue public money, which the conservatives supported for various reasons, both in terms of control and because I think a lot of them just felt like that was a good way to issue money. Looking at England, you know, they thought this was a good way to do it. So it became a huge political fight, and the reformers started, especially as of the 1830s, making constant efforts to democratize this money issuance. So the main bank in Upper Canada at the time was the Bank of Upper Canada, it was called. Two other banks got started somewhat later, one in Kingston called the Commercial Bank and one over in Hamilton called the Gore Bank. They were smaller operations. Commercial was big-ish. Gore was pretty small. Bank of Upper Canada was the dominant bank. It was the only one chartered for a very long time. So essentially all the money in the colony, when you read that quote, it says that almost all the money in the colony is banknotes. They're all from one bank. You know, everybody's money is coming from one institution through loans that are owed back to that one institution. So it literally has a contractual obligation attaching to just about everybody in the colony through this private organization. And the reformers hated it. So their initial efforts were to democratize that institution. There was a public stake in it. The colony owned some shares and got to appoint some people to the board. They wanted reformers appointed to the board, and that failed. They tried to modify the charter to make it more democratic and have a bigger public representation on the board. That failed. They then made lots of other efforts in the legislature. They tried to push for general incorporation for banks, quote unquote free banking. So anybody can get a bank charter. You don't have to be connected to the elites to get the legislature to give you a bank charter. Those efforts failed. They passed those laws almost every year over the 1830s, or did pass, propose those laws. They also proposed creating a land bank, a publicly owned land bank that would have branches throughout the colony that people could, there were land banks in the States that worked on this model, for anyone who wants to look them up, pretty fascinating. The idea was landowners, so we're thinking men, you know, we're thinking landed men, could go to a land bank and put up their land as security and get a loan. Typically, the land banks had a limit on the size of loans, though, so they weren't for very wealthy landowners. They would be for sort of a middle class who could get out a loan from the land bank. They would have to be repaid, of course, but it would offer liquidity expressly to cultivate land, promote agriculture, within a specific class who would be promoted. So in a sense, it was an equity measure, although was given the lots of limitations on who was granted access to that liquidity. They proposed something like that. The details are light, but I assume it would have been similar to land banks in, for example, Pennsylvania and elsewhere that worked on that model. They proposed a sort of public version of the Bank of Upper Canada. None of these went anywhere. They all got shot down. The legislature had two halves at the time. We don't have to talk about this here because it's a bit in the weeds, but one half was dominated by conservatives who got a lifetime appointment and could veto proposed legislation. And they used those seats to basically veto all of these efforts proposed by the reformers, who only briefly had a majority in even the elected aspect of the legislature as well. So they weren't like a dominant voice getting shut down, although they were a large and growing voice getting shut down constantly. and making constant efforts to democratize money. You know, they were firmly on the, this ought not be how we do it. There was something fundamentally wrong to them to have a public money, a public thing in everyone's pockets issued by for-profit private charter corporations that were not democratically accountable. It was deeply offensive to them, to all of them, really, even the moderate reformers over to the more radicals.
Fascinating. And so then how do they eventually end up founding a bank of their own, but this is in response to shifting circumstances and right and legal arrangements. Can you talk about how that all unfolds?
So there was some uncertainty as to whether you could start a bank without getting a charter from the legislature. This has a long history, going back to the Bank of England's monopoly, which anyone can chart on their own. But nonetheless, there was a government report called the Duncombe Report. I shouldn't say government report, an assembly report. Part of the legislature was called the Assembly. That's where the reformers had most of their base. And it was headed by this guy, Charles Duncombe, who was a reformer. He was a more radical reformer, on the same team as Mackenzie. And he, in this report, they essentially say, we surveyed the law and there's no British law that applies in the colonies and that would ban the starting of a bank on a joint stock basis. Today, we might find that confusing because we might think, oh, a joint stock company, corporation is the same thing. At the time, it was not considered the same thing. A corporation was granted a charter by the legislature. It could have limited liability, a key, and its powers were specifically prescribed by its enabling statute, by its corporate charter, usually by private act, although I think through the prerogative power, a governor or an executive could also create a corporation. In fact, I know they could. A joint stock company, also called a private company, so a corporation might be called a public company. A joint stock company, also called a private company, was kind of in between what we would today call a partnership and a corporation. So they could be formed privately through a private agreement and recognized at law. They could issue stock. They were not given limited liability, and they had a limited form of legal personality. So their status in court to sue on debts was somewhat more complicated. But nonetheless, they could establish a company in this way, issue shares to try to draw in a specie reserve to begin issuing notes. And the Duncombe Report basically said anybody who wants to can do this, and you can start a bank this way. So banks specifically don't need a corporate charter. The joint stock companies could already be formed, but they said you can start banks as joint stock companies. And so this started sort of a takeoff where reformers immediately started looking for a way to start their own bank, feeling frustrated and pushed out from the legislature or from legislative measures, let's say. The idea was then let's start our own institution. Let's just, go for it. And so they first attempted to start one called the Farmers Bank. And through some political maneuvering, some conservatives ended up crashing the board elections and getting on the board. And so all the reformers immediately bail and they say, no, we're not going to be part of this institution anymore. And I think it really underlines just how much this was a political move more than a business move. It was a business move. They made profit on it. But really, the idea was about control and politics. That was the governing thing. That's what all the discourse is about. The letter out to so then they start organizing for their own bank. And the letter out to people explicitly says we want like-minded political people, reformers, to start a bank. And they send a letter out, they get people together, and they start the Bank of the People. They hold the meeting in secret, so conservatives can't crash the board election anymore, and finally start their institution. They call it the Bank of the People in 1835.
You spend some time, both in the short vertical piece and in your larger law review article, talking about the aesthetics and iconography of the banknotes. That not just the Bank of the People issue, but in specifically in comparison to the elite banks and the elite Bank of Upper Canada's notes in particular. Can you tell us a little bit about those different aesthetics, those different designs? Talk about monetary design.
Sure. Yeah. Visual design. Right.
Yeah.
So the Bank of Upper Canada really saw itself as a Bank of England for the colony. And it never quite had that stature. It never had a monopoly on government business or anything like that. But you could tell they were going for this so hard when you look at the images of their notes. So there, for example, $1 note, at least in the 1830s, has a Britannica, or Britannia, I should say, who's a symbol of the Bank of England from its founding, in exactly her Bank of England pose. And she's got a shield, which has the Union Jack on it. And she's got the beehive next to her, which is also a Bank of England symbol. Apparently, it was originally a bank, quote-unquote bank, which I meant like a pile of coin. I thought that was, I don't totally understand that story, because I thought a bank referred to as a desk originally is the etymology of it, but like a desk where you would make accounts. But apparently it was a pile of coins, but it looked like a beehive. So they started drawing it as a beehive, and then that took over. It's like a Protestant symbol of industriousness. So you've got the Bank of England, Britannia there, with her shield and her scepter and the beehive, but now she's on the shore, presumably of the Americas, with like a British ship in the distance. And it says chartered by Parliament on top. The legislature of Upper Canada was not called Parliament. It was not allowed to call itself Parliament. It was the legislature. But, you know, they're saying, hey, close enough. You know, it was close enough to Parliament.
Yeah.
And it was referred to as Parliament sometimes. So it says, you know, chartered by Parliament. It's just so official and colonial. You know, it drips with that feeling. They've also got their $4 note has St. George slaying a dragon. You know, another just deeply British symbol. You could tell how much they wanted to embody that heritage, and did embody that heritage. And the Bank of the People's notes are just so radically different. So banknotes at the time were often issued by, not issued, printed by these banknote printing houses. Almost all the Upper Canada ones were printed by the same one in New York City. And the way they would work is, and I don't write this in the paper, so this is, you know, bonus for the podcast. You'd get these catalogs, which would have images, and then whoever's running the bank could pick what images they wanted in their note, and you'd write in a little order to the printing house, and they'd send you a bunch of notes. The notes didn't count unless they were signed. So when they were issued to people, they were signed. So this was less worry about counterfeit, although I'm sure there was some of that. And you look at the Bank of the People's notes, and they're just radically different. They have cityscapes on there. They have generic symbols of industry, like Demeter and Vulcan, who are common symbols of industry at the time. You've got boats. None of those harbors are images of Toronto, by the way. They're just random cities. Like, they have no relation to the city. You have one, the $4 note. I was always fascinated by this one. It has what looks like a portrait on the left of a guy, and it really does look like an actual portrait. It does not look like a generic image picked from the catalog. It might be. It might just be, you know, image of businessman, quote unquote. But it looks like a portrait, but I could never pin down who was a portrait of or why. I looked at images of various reformers, wondering if one of them, I thought maybe John Rolfe for a while, but I never figured it out. So it's an image. It might be a portrait. It might just be a generic business person, who knows, but there's nothing monarchical. There's no reference to England. It's all about sort of people and commerce and agriculture. And it's very down to earth, radically different imagery from what you would get from the chartered banks.
So I want to now shift the frame a little bit more to something that I honestly I think it's one of the parts of your research and your paper that I found to be the most kind of curious and fascinating, which is that these reformer monetary politics were in large part influenced by a broader North American monetary political movement that actually had deep roots in metallism.
Right.
And then, so you tell this story of how that kind of metallist ethos is strong at first, and then by necessity wanes because they're trying to create a bank that creates credit. And then, right, but it's very entangled and complicated. Can you walk us through where this metallism comes from and how it plays out?
Sure. So, metallism was on the rise in all across North America at this time, and for various reasons. You know, I think we often think, So here, I'm going to say a little bit about American monetary history and a pet peeve I have with how a lot of it goes. So a lot of American monetary history, not all, a lot, is presented this way. It says, hey, the U.S. had a central bank. It was called the Bank of the United States. It was great. And then it briefly lost it, and then it had a second central bank, the second Bank of the United States. And then it got vetoed by these backward-looking Jacksonian metalists who thought bank money is fictitious money, the only real money is metal. Isn't metal great? And they vetoed it because they were confused and antiquated. And then we have this thing called the Civil War, which puts us back on, you know, a footing with paper money chartered nationally with national banks, and eventually the Fed. And isn't that great? We're back onto sort of enlightenment and progress. Obviously, I'm oversimplifying, but you get that narrative quite a lot. And I think it's really wrong. And I'm not saying it's wrong because I'm a particular fan of the metalists, not at all. But I don't think metalism, and I've learned a lot of this from Ann Daly, who's a scholar. I think she's sometimes a little too generous with the metalists, but quite a good scholar. And I learned this from her. The metalists were not really a backward-looking movement. In a way, they were reactionary, no question, but in a way, a very forward-looking movement who opposed bank money, but didn't oppose money. And they didn't all necessarily even oppose bank money. I think they opposed bank money chartered by certain institutions because they wanted it issued by other institutions on different terms. And they promoted coin partially because a lot of them were going to make a lot of money off increased coin issuance. That's the American narrative. Canada swept up in that a bit. The opposition to bank money and the you know, the undemocratic nature of it, and the opposition to paper money were not unified in Canada, even though they get wound up with each other. So there is a following in Lower Canada and Upper Canada among the more radical reformers of the metalists in the States, and particularly Googe, who is an economist and wrote a famous metalist book. And it was a sort of, you know, they weren't, it's confusing because the metalist position isn't just that banks were undemocratic and therefore bad, which is part of it, excuse me. It's also that bank money is fictitious money, real money is metal. Metal is anchored by a social convention. These people are explicitly not money as a legal institution people. And issuing money through banks leads to volatility and economic uncertainty. And we need to give people something firm and stable that they can understand, which is metal money. And the reformers, even the reformers opposed to the chartered banks, did not all fall into that camp. Some of them were drawn to it. You know, Mackenzie at times is drawn to metalism. But for the most part, I think they were fine with paper money. They loved paper money. They just wanted it to be public. It was about control, really, more than about going back to a metal money. Although there was a presence among the more radical reformers of a metalism position, specifically among Mackenzie and his team. However, what I found really interesting was that when you get to the founding of the Bank of the People in the mid-1830s, even Mackenzie is becoming not a metalist. He's quite a brilliant guy, quite a brilliant thinker, but not always the most consistent thinker. And here, I think he explicitly really falls into the, he really switches teams and he starts to say, hey, paper money is maybe good. We just need to get a control over it. And this is right around the founding of the Bank of the People, which he's a supporter of. He gets a loan from it. He is a part of asking for a corporate charter at some point. So it's funny, the metalist presence is sort of in the background here, like it comes in, but it's not that dominant until you have the Panic of 1837. Now, the Panic of 1837, my favorite book about it, by the way, is called The Many Panics of 1837 by, I think her name is Lepler, Jane Lepler. I should make sure I get her name right. Jessica Lepler. My favorite book on the Panic of 1837, by the way, is called The Many Panics of 1837 by Jessica Lepler. It's a great book. The 1837 Panic, I think we forget just how big it was. By some estimates, second only to the Great Depression, really a global financial catastrophe, which affected the U.S. and Canada, all the Canadian colonies, especially Upper Canada. And during that time, of course, banks start failing. Banks start calling in their loans. Banks start suspending. Legislatures start allowing banks to suspend redemption of their notes. So for now, if someone comes to the bank with their note, the bank doesn't have to give them specie in exchange for it. And this leads to a resurrection among Mackenzie of the metalist position. and he starts printing in his paper constantly, take your money to the bank, exchange it. He starts being much more hesitant to support the Bank of the People in his paper. He still says he supports them, but he says, I never liked banks. I just supported them because they were useful to me, but banks have always been bad. Coin is a friend of the working class. It's a really interesting resurrection of that moment. But I really think it's also interesting that for the most part, the reformers were not metalists. They were not against paper money. They weren't even necessarily against bank money. They were against undemocratic bank money and undemocratic paper money. It was really for them about accountability, much more than it was about, say, limiting the money supply to precious metals or anything like that.
You're bringing up another important dimension, I think, that has social theoretical implications in addition to it just being empirically the case that this was going on, which is the kind of the politics of publicity in the press. And mm-hmm. we've noted how there's already a politics of publicity in the graphic design of the bills. But as you suggest in your paper, not only at the Bank of the People, there's some kind of reading room, right?
Yeah, they ran a reading room upstairs in their office. They called it a city newsroom. Yeah,
city newsroom, where mm-hmm. you can come and learn about and probably discuss the news, the politics of the day, right?
Right. Yeah. No, it's amazing.
And then they provide the liquidity for a newspaper, right?
Right.
That is then aligned with the politics of the bank.
Yes. Yeah. To an extent. So Mackenzie could never get a loan from the Bank of Upper Canada. And he wanted to start a new paper. And one of the first loans, one scholar says it's the first loan they gave, but I couldn't validate it. So one of the early loans the Bank of the People gives is to him to start this paper called The Constitution. It's the standard bearer of the more radical reformers, which again does not represent all of them, but you know, is a chunk. And it eventually prints the Constitution for Canada, his proposed Constitution for Canada, right before the rebellion he leads. And they start printing in his paper and in other papers a little ad. This is how I found out about this. It says that they had a city newsroom over the Bank of the People, which was on New Street. It's now Jarvis in downtown Toronto. It says, you know, the public are respectfully informed that the room is open from 9 in the morning till 9 in the evening, which is a long time, and that a constant supply is furnished of the leading liberal journals published in the two provinces that refers to the Canadas, London, Dublin, and Edinburgh, also the reviews, magazines, etc., and the principal New York papers. But then it says, for terms of admission, apply to Francis Hincks. He was the one of the founders of the bank and was the cashier of the bank. Cashier was sort of like general manager, and I think he was the only staff as well. So there's some terms to getting in. It's only liberal papers, right? It's sort of a room where we hang out and discuss. It's open all day. And there are some terms for getting in, but we don't know what those terms are. But we presume the terms are, you know, don't be involved with the conservatives or something like that. So really interesting. You're right. There's a great book about Upper Canada. I keep name dropping in this podcast. I apologize. But I'm recommending people I like. So Jeff McNairn wrote a great book about Upper Canada. It's a history of Upper Canada in this period. And it's specifically about that. It's about basically the ideas of democracy as hashed out in newspapers in Upper Canada at the time, and in these public newsrooms and in meeting rooms and in clubs. It's a great book. It's a very exciting period. And I think it was fascinating to see the Bank of the People as explicitly part of that. It was like, hey, we have this, you know, this business place, and it's where we're going to have these political meetings, and people can read these journals and be plugged into this discourse. It really underlines how much these were explicitly seen as public and political institutions, you know, engaging with public discourse.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, by the 20th century, at least in the United States, the term liberal right gets associated with a kind of neutral formalism, right? The kind of New Deal order. They tried to shy away from being accused of, you know, government propaganda and these kinds of things. And of course they produced all kinds of, you know, propaganda all the time. But it in terms of the way we think of money, this story expresses the ways that money is part of a politics of the press. It's part of the politics mm-hmm. of publicity. It's, you know, my colleague Rowan Gray always likes to, you know, play up the co-imbrication of like the history and politics of the printing press, right? Like Gutenberg's mm-hmm. printing press and, sure. you know, political economy.
Absolutely. I recently ran a workshop at Harvard on monetary history, and I had a whole lecture I gave on this note from the Bank of Canada in the 70s that has this big factory. It was about the factory was a big part of World War II. It was about celebrating industry and banknotes, which we don't do anymore, you know, and how it was representing a different era when the federal government was more explicitly involved in the economy, and happily so. No, I think you're right. There's so much imagery and discourse around money and physically how money's printed. It's you know, it's something even we in the legal history of money world don't pay enough attention to, I think, at times.
So then how does the Bank of the People falter? I mean, obviously this panic plays a huge role. It does well for a while. It's by all accounts well managed.
Yes.
At least the historical records suggest as much. But then they get caught up in this global banking panic. And so how does it end up essentially collapsing and being sold off? And where does the rebellion factor in this story?
So first off, I think it's worth pointing out that the bank was not some purely democratic public utopian institution. I think some people would have liked it to have been that. But I think by all accounts, it was a private organization that tried to turn a profit and did turn a profit. By all accounts, though, it was also lending to groups typically excluded from the other chartered banks who wanted liquidity. Mackenzie is just one example. We don't have really records of other loans from them, but this is suggested in the government reports, and I see no reason to disbelieve it. And it was also, the rumors are, or at least the evidence suggests, it was, I shouldn't say rumors are, let me scratch that. The evidence suggests it was a bit more generous with the terms of its loans than other banks. The way banks would issue loans through these promissory notes that we talked about before, they were typically due around, say, 6 months, 3 months. And then the person would come in and say, hey, my loan is due, and the bank and then would renegotiate to extend it. So often they wouldn't get repaid in full every 6 months. It would be renegotiated and extended. And so there's, of course, always room to wiggle around terms at those renegotiations. And the suggestion, and again, we don't have the bank's records, but this is a suggestion from the government reports and the fact that the bank, I couldn't find it in any of the published case law, like debt case law that we've seen. That doesn't suggest it wasn't there, because these are, not every case was reported. But at least I have not seen it in any debt litigation, with one exception. Which comes up later, the suggestion it was a bit more generous with terms. So lending to different people, being a bit more generous on his terms, but still a private organization, turning a profit, paying a dividend to its shareholders, who are all reformers. But by all accounts, it was also very well run. Francis Hincks was put in charge of it. He was new to Upper Canada, friends with the reformers. He would later on become a minister of finance and a very important person in Canadian life. During the 1837 panic, it was the only bank in Upper Canada not to suspend redemption. Suspend redemption, again, is a term which means you can refuse to exchange your notes for specie. It was the only bank that had sufficient specie reserve to never suspend redemption, even during the panic, which is a pretty remarkable fact. This is something that maybe most listeners won't care that much about, but if you study banking history, it's kind of, it jumps off the page at you. It's just shocking. So really well run, but the panic, along with the rebellion, even though it survived the panic in one sense, in another sense, the panic and the rebellion are the two moments that I think spelled the bank's undoing. So what happened with the panic was that the government authorized banks to suspend redemption, which all of them did except for the Bank of Upper Canada. Sorry, all of them did except for the Bank of the People. One of the offshoots of this was they gave the Bank of Upper Canada, which already had an outsized position in the banking sector, an even bigger one. Because if you wanted specie, say to make an international payment, or usually that was done either with specie or with bills of exchange, you typically had to go through the Bank of Upper Canada, which had the connections to London. So it had an even firmer monopoly position. It explicitly opposed the Bank of the People, and after the rebellion, even stopped accepting its notes. in exchange for its notes, and pushed it out of the market. So the Bank of the People had basically no way to supplement its specie reserves in a pinch and had to lend extremely conservatively. At the same time, in 1837, Mackenzie finally is fed up, and there's a rebellion in Lower Canada, which is a much more substantial rebellion than the one in Upper Canada. And he thinks, this is my chance. All the soldiers have been sent to Lower Canada to fight the rebellion there. I'm going to lead my rebellion here now and establish a Republic of Canada. So he marches into Toronto then, leads a rebellion, which is put down in a hot minute. It doesn't go anywhere, basically. And then he's exiled to the States along with many others. Many who are involved in the Bank of the People get exiled to the States. A lot of their key shareholders are exiled. And so this is sort of the beginning of the end of the institution. It sticks around until it's sold in 1840. But you can tell its position is shrinking. It doesn't have room for growth. And its time is waning due to these two things, in spite of being, by all accounts, well-run and a pretty impressive little institution.
So to close this out, why is this history important? I think we've been implying it. We've been variously saying it along the way. But just to come back to the what I always tell my students, the so what, right? Why are you writing this? There are lots of great details, but why does it matter? What does it teach us? I mean, so obviously it teaches us about a history that's been lost and forgotten, and now it's recovered. But what about money's future, as you put it in the title of your vertical piece for us?
I think we shouldn't take for granted the role banks have in our society. And I'm not saying banks are bad or that the people who run banks are bad at all. Quite the opposite. But, think about if you're living in Upper Canada in the 1830s, the only bank chartered is the Bank of Upper Canada. You need money. Everyone needs money. You can't live without money in a monetized society. You can't. So you need to either borrow from the Bank of Upper Canada, in which case you owe them a debt, right? They have something over you. Or you need to work for somebody who borrowed from the Bank of Upper Canada, because that's the source of liquidity in your society. So you get a social structure in which there are explicit lines of contractual obligation touching every person's pockets and drawing a straight line to this one institution, right? Which is not an elected institution. Now, today things are very different. The monetary system is different. We don't just have one bank. In Canada, we have effectively five, but still. We have more than that, but effectively. We don't only have one bank. We don't only have one institution. We have a central bank. Things are regulated differently. But the basics of this are more or less the same. The vast majority of our money is issued from banks through loans. So every one of us, we all need money, has to either borrow from a bank or work for somebody who borrowed from a bank. I'm sure your employer is paying you with money issued by a bank, right? So every one of us, basically, from our bank account, there's a straight line you can draw to these institutions, given a specific legal role, right? That's part of our political economy that didn't just happen, right? It was rolled out. It was rolled out deliberately and in a contested way. It's not like it was just, some tyrannical establishment of it. It was fought over and battled. But it was drawn out explicitly at a certain point, and we're living in that regime. And it's too easy for us to forget how explicitly our political economy is built around these institutions who are given an exclusive legal right to play this role, right? I'm saying exclusive, but in the States with the big shadow banking sector, maybe it's not so exclusive. But nonetheless, you get the idea. Yes, yes. And we shouldn't take that for granted. Right? I'm not saying this means, can the system get rid of banks? Everyone who runs banks is bad. In fact, quite the opposite. I think it's actually interesting, nuanced, and it might have a lot of benefits, a system like this. But we shouldn't take it for granted, right? We should engage with it, and not just economically, but politically and legally, because this is such a core aspect of the structure of our social lives today. The anchoring of finance is so key to everything government and anyone else does. You look at COVID, the first thing that happened during COVID was the central banks bailed out the financial sector before COVID even got that bad in this part of the world. COVID was not a financial crisis, right? It was a global health crisis. But the first thing we did was bailed out finance. And why did we do that? Well, we did that because finance plays a public role. If they failed, government would be very limited in what it could do to help people. So we had to bail out finance first. That's part of our legal architecture. That's not just a natural thing or a thing that just happened, right? And if we don't remind ourselves of where that architecture came from, why it was established, why it is the way it is, then I think we're starting a step backwards when we think about how to change our monetary system going forward, and when we think about what kind of democratic accountability we might want for our monetary system going forward. So that's what I find most striking about this history, is just a reminder that this arrangement was a contested thing. It was a thing rolled out at a certain moment. We're still living in it, and we should not forget that.
One of my favorite lines in your longer piece is, every money is addressed to a community. Because it perfectly, I think, crystallizes what the kind of orthodox framework leaves out. Money isn't, in the orthodox framework, addressed to a community. There's no addresser or addressee. It's merely private exchange, wills meeting and coming and going, and arbitration can happen if things go wrong, but otherwise it's sort of pre-mediated in a way. Whereas the line, every money is addressed to a community, suggests that, well, that this addressing is happened. There is an addresser, an addressee, and it raises the question, what kind of money, what kind of address, what kind of community? And I think that this kind of historical work is so important for raising those questions. So I really appreciate what you've been working on.
Oh, thanks, Scott. Thanks. And I appreciate you having me on. It's been great.
So just to spell out the full title of your paper, because I kind of hand waved the longer title at the top of this. I have it in front of me, so I'm going to read it. The full title of the paper is The Bank of the People, 1835 to 1840, Law and Money in Upper Canada. And it is currently available on SSRN, and we have links to this in your vertical piece. Hopefully people have already begun to check it out. If not, I say go check it out. And then it's forthcoming in the Osgoode Law Journal, but that might take a little while. So check out SSRN until that happens. So to close us out, I wanted to ask you, where can our audience find you? And also, is there anything you'd like to plug or make us aware of?
Great, thanks. So you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Dan Eric Rohde. It's all one word, is my Twitter handle. You can also see me on justmoney.org. It's our website that we run with lots of great money stuff. So if you like the stuff, look there. And also, I'd like to give a shout out to a conference we're planning at Harvard Law School this June. It's June 15th to 17th. Money as a Democratic Medium 2.0. The first one was 5 years ago. It was a huge success. And I think the follow up is going to be even better. So if anyone's interested, please book a seat. Look at the schedule. It's on the website. It's on justmoney.org. And I'd love to see you there.
Great. Thanks. Looking forward to talking again in the future.
Thanks, Scott. Looking forward to it.